First and foremost, I want everybody to take a deep breath and relax, okay?
I feel like my eyes sticking to one side of my brain and shit. You know what I mean?
Go to bed, man.
Okay, my name is Taylor Dunn. Y'all keep it going.
You are now listening to the Mac Daddy Seminar, motherfucker.
What's cracking, pimps? What's going on? And welcome to episode 56 of the Mac Daddy Seminar. As always, I'm your host, Taylor Dunn, and on today's episode, we have a guest. When I first got here to California, I wanted to take a comedy class to kind of get accustomed to the Wild Wild West out here, and this guy was one of the teachers of that class. I'm talking about Jesse Egan. Jesse Egan is a nationally touring comedian. He can often be seen alongside Vicky Barbalak, who was a finalist on America's Got Talent. He was the host of San Diego Tonight. He was the winner of the Funniest Person in San Diego competition. And you can watch his special for free right now on drybarcomedy.com. His special is titled That's the Spirit. Please give it up for my guest, Jesse Egan.
Sorry, say again.
How's it going?
Good. How are you? Sorry.
I'm doing good.
Earpiece in.
So, how's this lockdown been treating you? I'm trying to figure out how to make it on the speaker view.
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right.
Oh, my hair is disappearing. the lockdown has been okay. Wow, that's neat. I'm like in a Stargate. I've spent most of my time with my girlfriend, who I proposed to recently during this pandemic. So she said yes, so we'll be getting married. And
congratulations. I meant to say that. Yeah, that's awesome, man.
So that's really what I've done is we've spent a lot of time together. And I think that was good for our relationship. I know it's probably a challenge for some people, but she's a wonderful person, so we've had a nice time. And I felt a little guilty because, you know, right when this thing started, I was saying to myself, like, boy, I wish I could just have a break for about a year and just do nothing, you know. And then it all hit, and then you're forced to do nothing and realize, yeah, you lose your purpose. Without a purpose, it's difficult to keep your morale up. I think it's like, you know, we define ourselves by what we do, kind of. And you know, when you think I'm a comedian and then you don't do any comedy, you're like, well, what the hell am I now? So that was a tough one, I think, was not having anywhere to perform and doing a few Zoom shows and teaching a few classes online and things like that to just stay in the midst of doing comedy. And it really wasn't until I was coming back and performing again that I started to really write new material about, you know, all the things I've been going through during this past year. But I felt at first, boy, I really missed an opportunity. I haven't written hardly anything. And I think that's because it's sort of in a void of experience, you know, without doing things and going out and living, you don't have as much to joke about or write about. So I was just kind of in a little bit of a funk there. But going back, you know, having to prepare for some shows, sort of went back over the last year and wrote some of those thoughts down and started to generate material again, which is really, forget about the vaccine, that's a real shot in the arm, you know?
Oh, yeah. I'll be honest with you. We've been on this podcast for maybe 60 seconds, and you literally just talked about everything that I've complained about for the past year. Every podcast episode that I've tried to stay consistent with it. And that was my big thing. Like, I'm going to do this. This is going to be my outlet. I'm just going to grow my podcast while we're in lockdown. And week by week, I'd get guests and, okay, this is interesting. And, you know, I was coming up with new bits and stuff to go over on the podcast. And then eventually it's just like, okay, when is this going to end? And then, you know, the whole time it's like, oh, this will be over in 2 weeks. This is great. You know, I'm thinking, oh, this is exactly what I needed, because I'd really hit a stride of momentum unlike I had ever had before. And, you know, I was performing multiple times a week. I was getting up in front of bigger crowds. And then I was like, there was right before everything locked down, I got a pretty good opportunity. And I'm pretty sure it's long gone by now, so I don't mind talking about it. But I was in touch with the guys at Vet TV. I don't know if you've heard of them.
Cool.
Yeah, they put on a show at the Comedy Store in La Jolla the night of the lockdown. The one in LA had closed, and I had tickets for this Vet TV show. And, you know, they asked me if I wanted to come out because they saw this big, you know, show that I did here on Coronado like a week before. And they were like, yeah, you should come check it out and you can meet the producer. So I'm super excited. And they basically put together a military mini comedy special.
Wow.
So it was previous military veterans and people even on active duty were coming out and doing little 15-minute sets. So I was like, oh, this is great. So I was, I mean, on cloud 75. And then, boom. And then at the same time,
was that right before this hit? Was that right before the pandemic?
I was there on March 13th. That was like the day before, you know, God Emperor Newsom came out and was like, hey, we're shutting it all down. And at the time, everybody was on board with it. You know, I was like, you know what? This is great. You know, I'm going to be off work for a little bit. I can just sit here and write. Like, this is going to be, you know, the best 15 minutes I've ever come up with. And here we are in April of 2021. And, you know, I've done a podcast with one of the producers of the show. I did that back in like June, but, you know, since then it's just been kind of, hey, we're just playing it by ear. So I haven't burned any bridges, hopefully, but
that's good.
And I would love the opportunity to do it again, but
yeah,
you know, like you said, man, it's been tough to stay motivated, and without the experiences of going here, going there, it really doesn't make those neurons fire in your head to think of those jokes.
Yeah. And also like quarantining, you know, or just like being isolated in general, being away from other people, it's another thing that takes away all of the prompts for you know, something funny. Like a lot of times my girlfriend will point out whenever I start ranting angrily about something, she'll go, oh, write that down, that's a new bit, you know. And that comes from like, you know, interacting with people and them pissing you off or whatever. And when you don't interact with anyone, or hopefully something good will happen when you interact with them too, maybe you're right about that, but I think anger is pretty funny. Yeah, I just think without personal contact, going out and doing things, you know, even just like for me, I'll just like take a walk around the neighborhood and I come up with more ideas than I would if I'm just sitting at home looking at the cursor. You know how Seinfeld talks about that cursor blinking at you, like, you got anything? And you're like, oh, yeah. And that's why he just writes his jokes, because he hates that cursor. But yeah, I feel like it's much easier to come up with things. And tell me if you feel this way. Sometimes if I'm doing something, like my body's physically engaged in an activity, like driving, showering, shaving, walking the pier, you know, doing something where mechanically your mind is engaged in this thing, but then the other part of your mind sort of takes flight and starts to create new ideas. It's almost like there's something symbiotic about, you know, moving and doing actively doing something and your brain being active, and you know, as opposed to like sitting there and just concentrating on writing and then nothing is coming. Do you ever have that experience?
Oh, absolutely. Like I'll try, like that was a big thing. I was like, okay, we're not gonna get to go do this or go do that. I'm just gonna turn myself into a tank this summer. And obviously I fell short of that, but you know, we just, I started running more and just started doing whatever I could for exercise. And I'd be out on a run around my neighborhood and I would just start thinking of these ideas. And I was like, man, if I could just write this down right now, this would be perfect.
Yeah.
And it even got to the point to where, you know, I would stop whatever podcast I was listening to and I'd be running and I would start recording just my voice saying it.
Dictate it in there. And yeah, absolutely. And I just thought of the, you know, the concept that like an object at rest stays at rest and an object in motion stays in motion. I feel like that is sort of applicable to what we're going through with this pandemic. It's like the longer we sat there doing nothing, it's sort of the worse it got. Whereas like you get out there, the ball's rolling and you sort of pick up steam, you know, both in writing, performing, just the repetition of things and life in general. I just feel like the stagnation of this last year. I mean, I've turned into a tank myself. I've gained some weight on this pandemski.
No, I have too. It may not be showing right now, but it's all
only good
down
thing
here.
About Zoom, right? Is they can't see it. But yeah, I think it's been tough, and I'm really glad to now, you know, sort of, I got my first shot. I'm waiting for a second vaccination coming up soon. And
awesome.
I'm hoping that, you know, once we get to that level of enough people that it's sort of the risk of getting it will be, you know, decreased significantly, and hopefully we'll get back to doing, and you know, certain things, and maybe there's silver lining to certain things, like the fact that we've, I don't want to say mastered, but started using the Zoom technology, which is not like great for stand-up, but for other things, I think there's some level of silver lining, like being able to connect with people and write together or participate in podcasts and things like this without actually having to drive there and burn gas and getting, you know, maybe getting an accident. You know, I've had all kinds of things happen when you leave the house. And I think there is something nice to like certain things to be able to say, oh, I'll just jump on with Taylor. We could be anywhere in the world and do this. And so I think that's pretty amazing too. You know?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Like I've connected with so many people. Like when I started, you know, when quarantine really hit, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to start bringing on guests because everybody's inside. They'll be more adept to say yes. So I interviewed old high school classmates. I've interviewed teachers. And then I started being like, well, who else could I get on here? And I've had a rapper on here. I had Zoltan do an episode with me. I'd never met Zoltan in person. And I just reached out to him. I was like, hey, man, I do a podcast. I like a lot of your stuff. Would you mind being on? And we had a great episode.
Yeah. I mean, he's really my favorite comedian. And I think we were talking about earlier, I really learned from him, which is, you know, go out and experience things. I mean, his whole act is just 5-minute stories of his life. And he really rarely embellishes them at all. It's just like, I've been in the car with him on the way to a gig and he's talking about something that we're experiencing together. And then he goes up and does it on stage and it blows your mind that he can be that funny that fast. But I think it's a good lesson, which is like, get out and do things and live life and experience those. And those are your stories. You know, I'm sure you've had that question from a million people. They ask you, where do you come up with your act or where do you get your jokes from? And I assume that 99% of us, the answer is the same, which is it's our life, you know, which is funny. You'd think, well, they would know that already. But I think people that ask that really don't watch a lot of stand up to know that it's our life, you know, and without a life, you have no story. So I think his brand of comedy is actually the most difficult one, which is storytelling. You know, for me, I like short minute long jokes with a lot of wordplay and act outs and voices and sort of some fireworks show that I can do performance wise if I can. Whereas storytelling, at least from my point of view, is more difficult. It's challenging because you have to have a point. You know, if someone starts telling you a story in real life or on stage, you're going to be like, well, what's the point of this? Like, why do I need to know about your neighbor? Why do I,
who,
I don't even care. I don't know them. Like I would tell people, personalize your story so that it's about you and not your friend or your neighbor or whatever. Then maybe they'll care about it a little bit more. But in general, I find that storytelling, it's almost like you have to have a moral to the story. You have to have a lesson that you've learned from it that you're imparting to the audience, because no matter how funny it is, they're still going to be like, well, what was the point? You know? But I always feel like with Zoltan, it becomes crystal clear what the premise is, the point of it is, and the punchlines are always there. So really learned a lot from him. That's great that you had him on as a guest and all these other people, you know, to share their experiences. I'm sure that's sort of helped you generate your own material as well.
It has. And t- touching back on Zoltan, like, you know, I'd watched some of his stuff. I'd really just heard about it around town. Like, everybody would be like, oh, you gotta listen to Zoltan. They'd be like, who's your favorite San Diego comedian since I moved out here? And I was like, I don't know. Like, a lot of it I was saying, like, you and Gordon Downs, you know, because that was really the two, what I would consider veteran guys around me. And they were like, have you heard of Zoltan? And I was like, no. So I looked him up on Instagram and I started watching some of his videos that he's posted. And then I just reached out to him. I was like, hey, man. And he was so nice. And he was willing to listen to me, who's, you know, barely even an open micer, and, you know, kind of explain my side of things and different things that I've gotten to do. And he gave me a lot of tips. And I mean, I couldn't have been more thankful that he did that for me. And then, you know, I go and I watch his special that he released on YouTube. And I was like, man, this is something else. Cause it just seems so, I know he puts a lot of work into his act, but it seems so effortless.
Yeah.
And that's what really makes it so good. Easy.
He really,
it's just like, it's like he's just up there talking. It's almost like you could, if you weren't a big fan of stand up, you could watch that and be like, oh, he's just up there being himself. But you can tell he's tweaked it and worked it that way to make it sound like, hey, I'm just a nonchalant guy just up here.
Right.
Telling you, right, how it
you
is.
Really own the character, and the character is him. And I think that's when you say he's up there just being himself, that is like the key to stand up. But, you know, I think Lou Brockman, who was the keyboard player at the Comedy Store La Jolla, and he brings everyone up on stage, he's really sort of my mentor for stand up. Even though he doesn't perform stand up, he's seen everybody. He's seen it all for years and years, you know, 25 plus years, I think, at the Hollywood Store, or at the La Jolla Store. And he told me once that, you know, the closer that you can get to really being your true self, the better. You know, you're going to be an amplified version of the character on stage, but that, you know, that embellishment, that sort of amplification of your true self is the key, he would say. And I always felt that too, that I sometimes could detect a disconnect between my real self and my performance. And I could feel, maybe the crowd couldn't sense it, but I could feel that it was a little bit off. But sometimes you just are really in the pocket. You're like, I'm just being me and I'm enjoying it. And I'm not performing outside of myself looking in. I think those are the best performances that you give, you know. And Zoltan's a good example of making it look easy, because he really has tapped into that. Like, I know who I am. I know my own voice. I'm a storyteller. I talk about my life and I'm honest. And he's opinionated and he owns that, you know. And I think that's, he understands that character. And I think it's harder to do stand-up when your character is not you, you know. If you're going to be a performance piece like an Andy Kaufman or something, where your character is this other thing, this other person that lives, you know. Some people would say about Vicky Barbalak, who I tour with often, that is a character. It's really not. It's really like, even off stage, she's decked out in animal print with the wigs on, and she lives in a trailer park. So just because her character is crazy, that doesn't mean that's not her. Exactly like her off stage and on stage, she's really the exact same person.
Right. It's more like an Andrew Dice Clay.
Yeah. Andrew Dice Clay is probably more of that example of someone who has to turn it on when they get on stage, because I don't know that for a fact. Maybe off stage he's like, oh, but I doubt it, you know?
Right. I mean, if you watched like A Star Is Born, he wasn't necessarily funny in that role. And I thought he did really well in it. And at times I was like, when I first watched it, I was like, is that Andrew Dice Clay? And I was like,
I liked him in that.
Yeah. I thought it was great.
I liked him in that. I think I liked the tone down, or the, you know, the more human version of him.
Yep, him just being the dad.
Yeah, he was great in that. Yeah. Great movie.
Like you said, though, like, you know, tapping into that really good feeling when you know you're just being 100% of yourself. Like, obviously, I've only done stand-up, I would say, probably in the 50 to 60 time range. And I've maybe felt that sensation five times. And one time was the showcase for the comedy class that you and Gordon Downs taught, and Bijan as well.
Yeah, that was fun.
That was just like, I don't know what it was. It was something about that audience, but yeah, you could just hear it. Like, man, they are really with me. Yeah. And that sense of reassurance that you feel is like, I can't, there's not a drug on earth that can make you feel that feeling.
Isn't that funny that that's the way people really do get addicted to doing stand-up? I had a friend who used to bomb all the time. Like, every time you'd see him, he would bomb. And one time on stage, he had this like moment of clarity where he told the audience, he goes, "You guys see me every week. I bet you're wondering, why does he keep doing this every week? Just bomb." And he goes, "I'll tell you why. Because one time I did really well, and I've been chasing that ever since." You know, I mean, it's that dragon. It's the heroine of comedy. It's like, once you get that feeling, nothing is as good as that. You know, it's like a feeling of true acceptance of yourself, and the world accepts you. These audience people love you. You realize you're good at something. And I think in that showcase environment, you know, that's people that came to root for you. They came to show you that love. It would be like maybe one day when you and I are doing theaters and we're famous and people love us and they're paying a premium ticket price to come see you, you know, that kind of thing where they're there for you. Not like, oh, I just got ambushed in this shitty dive bar and I didn't know there was going to be stand-up, and now there's stand-up, and no matter how good you are at stand-up in that environment, you'll never have that same feeling of like, these people came to show me love, you know, and it's just an incredible feeling. I think that early showcase, that early experience of your friends and family coming out to root for you is like probably the best it ever gets, you know, until maybe we get to that other level of, you know, now I've done a few bringer shows and realize it's more fulfilling if I can get strangers to react like that. If I can get your strangers to react, you know, in stitches, just dying laughing, it's so fulfilling, you know. And then maybe at the next level of, you actually have fans that are not only, and I've had a few experiences where it can backfire. Like, I had someone come to a show that I think it was a competition or a contest or one of those things, and the person sat in like the front row, almost middle of the crowd, and he's doing my jokes. He's mouthing them and he's saying them out loud, partly like he's saying them. And then he's like hitting the punchlines before I'm doing them. And I'm like, "Hey man, I get it that you are like, please stop." Like, it was really screwing me up. And it just screwed up the whole set of like, he's, before I can get to it, in that pause where you build up the tension in the audience, he's throwing out the punchlines. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, I think that's where having an actual fan can like backfire. I've only had that happen once, but
that sounds like a nightmare.
That was a nightmare.
And at the end of the day, like, you, he meant well.
He
obviously was such a big fan of you that he was like, you know, he knew your jokes by heart. But at the same time, it's like, look man, I'm hyper focused up here. If somebody drops a glass or something, it could throw me off. And that's one thing that's always really been one of my biggest fears is, and I've had it happen several times where I'm in the middle of my set and you go blank. So I've tried to work my way out of that by being like, you just got to keep talking, just start observing what's around you. And it happened, actually the last time I did stand up in front of a crowd, I did it in November. And that's the only time during the pandemic where it wasn't a Zoom show. It was actually on a stage in front of a crowd in a comedy club. I went back to my home, like where I first started in Birmingham, Alabama. We went back for Thanksgiving and I got booked on a, like a Christian comedy show, like 100% clean. And I sent them like a video actually of the showcase for the class. I sent them that and I said, I can be clean. Like, that's no problem. And they said, okay, sounds good. And, I went up there and I mean, right out of the gate, like it was, what's the correct way to put this? It was a more urban audience.
Where was the show?
It was in Birmingham, Alabama, at the Stardome.
I was going to say, I performed at the Stardome, and I was wondering if it was there. That's an impressive place, that big, huge stage. And yeah, so right off the gate, it wasn't a clean
show. No, it was like, to give you an idea, they opened the show with someone singing a gospel song.
Okay.
Yeah. And everybody was clapping and cheering and hooting and hollering. It was on a Sunday. And so I'd
what
say.
What time? Is this in the morning?
No,
maybe
no,
you were
no.
just at church.
It was 6 p.m.
Wow.
People were showing up dressed for church.
Oh, wow.
But
wow.
It was in the evening. And, you know, I was like, I'm only going to be here for 3 weeks. So I'll take anything I can get. I'll do it. And it being on the main stage in the main room, I was like, yeah, I'll take that. Because the last time I performed there, I was 18 years old. I'd only done stand-up 3 times previous to going on that main stage. So this was like the big homecoming thing. And, you know, I had it was awesome. And the middle of my set, I just got so worked up and so excited. I just, and I start blanking for a second. Inside your head, it's like, you know that scene in SpongeBob where he like loses, he forgets his name and all of the little SpongeBobs are running around burning all the filing cabinets and stuff. It was like that. It's like, what is his name? What is his name? And you're just, what's the next thing to say? But I ended up picking it back up. It was real quick. And
my you think buddy, they noticed or no?
My buddy that came with me, he said, it seemed like you stumbled just a little bit in the middle, but you caught it. And I don't think a lot of other people did.
Okay. Okay.
So
he knows you well. So he may notice. Yeah. That stage is so big, though. I remember performing there and having this feeling of like everything's going right. I can't even make a mistake up here for whatever reason that night. I don't know. I think it was that stage. I said, I feel like Chris Rock up here. And I started like pacing back and forth and, you know, white people. And I just loved it. And I thought that, I think it's the height of the stage that I loved, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Way up there. And it's just like you have this commanding sort of presence. It's amazing. I could see that style. They say that in Hawaii, the sort of style, and I don't know if this is still accurate, but I had a comedian friend tell me that the style in Hawaii of stand-up is much more preacher style, like Chris Rock, you know, pacing, loud, you know, sort of angry or not angry, but you know, really speechifying, you know, really, right. You know, really projecting. And that's kind of how I felt there at the Stardome, you know?
Oh yeah. And you will know if you're not doing well. Like a lot of people on the show were either just like me. They were like super amateur open micers that had just done it over the years and knew how to throw together a 5 to 7 minute set. And there was a guy who came down from New York. It was a competition and he ended up winning. And he went right after me. And the very first joke I could hear from backstage, I was like, he just won. Cause the noise, it shook the building. And that was fine. I didn't care about winning. I was just so happy to do comedy in a club again. Like I was like, I'll come in dead last and that's fine. But there were some people you could tell that they'd only done it a few times and that crowd let them know, like, we're not vibing with you. And it was excruciating, but that's, you know, that's part of it. You know, you got to love it enough to have that happen to you and come back and want to do it again. And that's, you know, what makes people fall in love with it. But I've told you about how, you know, I started stand up a lot when we were in the class and I even touched on it just now since we've been doing this episode. But I wanted to ask you, how did you get into stand-up? Like, how old were you? When was your first time on stage?
Well, I mean, I think the first time I ever really like performed comedy, I was like a kid. I was just performing for my parents. I remember the first time I ever killed. That's why I bring it up, because to me this was the time. I think I was 13 or 14 or something, and we had gone to my grandparents', you know, one of these old folks communities. And if you've ever been to one of those places, they have a lot of rules for everything. Everything is like just huge rule books. And we went into like their, the clubhouse to like play ping pong. And on the ping pong table, there was like a book, like an encyclopedia. And it said the laws of table tennis. And I just thought it was so funny that, like, even ping pong, they could take the fun out of it, you know? So I started reading these laws in, like, a really, like, thick, like, British-y kind of accent. And my parents are just dying, and my younger brother is on the floor rolling. And I'm looking at them going, my gosh, this is, like, a superpower. Like, I feel like they can't even move. They're just so immobilized with laughter. That was the first time I thought, there's something here. This is really something else. My brother's really funny, and he would make me laugh a lot. My younger brother around the dinner table. And I just kind of gravitated to that in school, of like trying to make people laugh. I did a lot of acting and theater stuff in school. I would try to sort of incorporate that, you know, comedy into things, like doing Neil Simon plays and things like that. And that's before I ever did stand up. When I moved to California from the East Coast, I grew up in Virginia. And when I moved to California, I tried to do one of these workshops, like the kind that you took with me, but this was less formal. There was no instructors, and was sort of a group of open micers trying it for the first time. And we would get together, I think somewhere, maybe at Twigs or some coffee shop, you know, at the time. And then I had a show, like we finally did a show, and it was at a bar called Poppy's in Claremont. And I remember that first set that I did, because I had worked on the material with these other people in this workshop for a very long time. In my mind, it was a month or 2 months, but that seemed like a long time. And that first set of a few minutes, I think, did well, at least in my mind, because I had invited everyone, of course, and my friends come and they all laugh. So then I got to do this again. I'm going to go back the next week, and I tell all my friends, hey, come back and see me again. And they're like, somebody said, you're not going to do those same jokes again. And I didn't have any other jokes. So I just thought, oh, crap, I got to write new material. And as you probably know, you know, writing a whole new set a day before, I mean, you can imagine how that went. I bombed. I got really drunk. I got in a fight, I think, in the pool table room. I don't remember everything that happened. I just know there was one of those Budweiser cutout ladies, and I was dancing with her, and something happened with somebody playing pool. I got thrown out of there. I had to come back the next day and ask for my wallet back. And it was so embarrassing. That night went horribly. More horrible things happened that night. And it, so horrible, in fact, that I never did stand up again for like 2 years after that. That was it for me. I had tried it those two times. I quit. And I think it wasn't until like 2006 that I 2006. What the hell year is it now? God, how long am I doing stand-up?
Is that right? You at 16 years?
Oh, my God. I should be much better at this. But anyway, it was really at Winston's that I started doing it again. You know, we started a thing called Ocean Beach Comedy, and we had very few comics, three or four comics. I wasn't a comic. I would just host the thing, and we would get the audience to write ideas and put them in a hat, and the comics would come up. It's something they call fun mug now. They pull this idea out of the hat and they'd riff on it and try to make stand-up out of it. Eventually, I got tired of the ideas that the audience would put in there. They were bad. Asparagus, I got nothing. So then I would write my own joke ideas and put them in the hat. I'd go up there to host. I would watch the comic butcher my idea. I got irritated after a while. I said, I'm going to do these. And so I started doing it. And that's how I got into stand-up, was by watching people do it worse than how I thought. I thought I could be funnier.
Oh, you could do it better,
you know. I think it's a combination of those two things when you start, that you think like you see someone great and say, I want to do that. You see someone bad and go, I could do that, you know. And most guys are overconfident anyway, and they think they could do anything, so then they try it, you know. That's really how I started.
For me, I grew up loving Jim Carrey, Adam Sandler, things like that. I mean, I used to remember like acting out the scene from The Mask with my mom when I was like 6 or 7 years old, when he's in like the club and everything, and like he does the cowboy impression when they're shooting at him, and he's like, you got me, partner. Like, my mom will still talk about that to this day. And I adore Jim Carrey. My entire childhood, I still do now. And
me too, so much.
When I was in high school, I had this idea in my head. I was like, I want to try and become an actor. So I got into theater, and, you know, we did this competition every year called Trumbauer, where you would go and the schools would face off against each other, and you had to find a scene that you want to perform at Trumbauer. So I started looking online, and there was a lot of like stuff that I just didn't really feel comfortable doing. Of course, there was Shakespeare, and, you know, there was a, what's the guy's name who's Mr. Bean? Rowan. You know who I'm talking about.
I don't know what his real name is.
I think it's Atkinson.
Okay.
But,
Rowan.
It was just, Rowan.
You said Rowan,
We'll just say Mr. Bean.
That's his Christian name, Mr. Bean.
I could never find a scene that I wanted to do. So I was like, well, I'll write my own scene. I'll just come up with something and I'll write it. And I brought that in there and showed it to my theater teacher. And he was like, you wrote a scene? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, I've never had a student do this before.
That's great.
And he was just ecstatic. I've actually had him on the podcast and we've talked about this before. And
oh, cool.
When he was like, you're, talent is not in acting, you need to work on writing, because these are some good scenes. Like, I took them to the competition and I ended up winning the regional competition, but I didn't win the state. And so that from that point on, I was like, I'm gonna try and be a comedian. Well, an 18-year-old comedian, my very first time going on stage was in that little side room in the Stardome. I called up there. I booked it. I bought tickets for my mom and my girlfriend, who's now my wife. And we went up there, and I wouldn't let them hear any of my jokes.
Okay.
They were like, what are you going to talk about? I'm like, you'll see. Because I wanted it to be a show for them. I didn't want them to know what I was going to say, because I wanted their reactions to be genuine.
Sure.
I'm the youngest person there. I'm 18. The next person, I think the closest person in age to me was like 27, 28 years old. And people, I mean, these are people that have been doing it for 10 plus years. So I'm super nervous. And then out of the corner of my eye, my dad walks in. And I haven't seen my dad in like 7 years.
You're kidding me.
No, I'm like, what in the world? And I'm just like, I didn't say anything to him at first. Will you give me just 1 second? I think my daughter is knocking on the door.
Oh, yeah.
I'll cut this part out.
Wow. The dad connection right there that just occurred. His dad shows up, then his daughter shows up for her dad. And I just watched Interstellar last night. There's a lot of dad stuff.
Sorry about that.
No sweat.
So, so my dad is walking in with his new wife, and I'm in shock because I'm like, this is, you know, I've been looking forward to this for like a month. I have my material ready to go, and I'm 10 times more nervous.
Way to ruin it, Dad.
Well, I ended up, you know, I was hanging out backstage, not really talking to anybody, just in this small little broom closet of a green room. And I go out there and I just used all that energy, made eye contact with him, ended up doing great. And I ended up winning. That was the, it was a competition. So if you won in that small little room, they would invite you back to perform on the main stage for like the year competition. And that's, I ended up getting third place in that one. But that was my first time. So
that's an awfully good first time.
It was awesome.
My gosh, what pressure.
Oh yeah. But I'll tell you one thing, after I won that and got it on video, and I could, you know, this was in a time where you could, you know, post things to Facebook easily. This was 2012. And man, you want to talk about somebody's head being inflated to the point of no return. Like, I walked around with my nose up in the air, like you couldn't tell me anything. It was
because
like I was going to be.
Because you won, right?
It was because I wanted it, you know, it was something I could show to people. So yeah, that kind of touches on like what you said, that, okay, now I have to come up with a new set because I've posted it on Facebook. Everybody's seen what I've done.
Now they've seen all these jokes. Yeah, I know. You got to match them and exceed them now. It's hard. Yeah, you got to just keep going.
But
Same thing when someone steals your jokes. I don't know if you've had that happen, but I've had that happen. And sometimes people will steal your joke and then, you know, you get all upset. I had a wise comedian tell me once, he's like, don't worry about it. You'll write more stuff. They can't write. That's why they're stealing your jokes. Don't worry about them. Just keep doing your thing. So it was still a hard pill to swallow, but I think it's worth remembering. Yeah, if you have the talent to write like that, you just keep generating more stuff.
But yeah, I don't think I've had anybody steal a joke yet. I say that, but I mean, I haven't been down to a lot of the clubs, even now that they are starting to open, and I haven't really been out to any of the outdoor clubs because for me, being in the military, I'm probably giving away too much information right now, but it's the truth. We signed a page 13 in June of last year that basically says, hey, you're not operating like what the county says or whatever. So the Navy put out this big fragmentation order essentially saying, hey, you can't go to a restaurant and sit down and eat. You cannot go to a civilian barbershop. Basically, you can't go anywhere where there are people, regardless of what the county says. And not until we peel this back will we change any of that. So pretty much everything I've done, if I do it, I'm having to be like under the radar and I'm risking getting in trouble through my job. So, you know, I'm like, it's one thing to be in Walmart with a mask on and, you know, you can kind of blend in with the crowd. But when you walk up on a stage and there's a spotlight on you, it's a little bit harder to kind of hide. Oh, no, I wasn't there. I was like, oh, yeah, you were.
Looks like you're going to have to do some open mics at Walmart with a mask
on. Oh, yeah. I mean, I've done the Zoom shows. And, you know, like I said, when I went back to Alabama, I did a show then. But, you know, like you said at the beginning, just coming up with the new material has been so tough. Like, I'll sit there and I'll have a conversation with a group of friends, and I feel like, man, if I had just pressed record during that, I would have an hour.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something my friend used to call kitchen comedy. Like, you're at your funniest when you're in your kitchen talking to your friends, you know. You're at a party in the kitchen and your buddies are around and you're riffing back and forth. You'd never be funnier than that. If you could take that and bring it to the stage somehow. I always try to imagine that the people in the audience are my friends in that kitchen, you know, like, oh, that's why I'll tell a joke right to someone or like to, you know, because it's kind of like, and then also in that atmosphere, isn't it usually busting balls on somebody or something? You know, everyone's riffing, but they're probably like all making fun of something. So like sometimes on stage, that'll be the thing too, of like, we're all making fun of this one thing, or, you know, I'll sometimes nickname someone in the audience and then do the joke and sort of tag it with their name, you know, with them, like, you know, Pitbull over here knows what I'm talking about. And somehow that conduit, it like functions to me like that kitchen comedy thing of like, oh, we're all, I'm not even busting on him necessarily, but it's still like everything is through that one, you know, busting balls maneuver of like, you know, the whole audience focal point, this one guy back to the whole audience, you know. It's this little thing, I don't know exactly why it works, but it's kind of like I'm not talking to a whole cloud of sort of, you know, faceless people. I'm talking to a whole bunch of individuals, you know. I'm talking to you, I'm talking to everybody, but I'm really telling you this, and everybody's also sharing in it, you know.
Right.
It's like this shared experience of like, ooh, we all got this inside joke because he's really just telling it to him. Maybe that I'm sort of figuring out my own comedy as I describe it to you right now.
Oh, I understand. I remember you bringing that up during the class. Like, when we were talking about different techniques that you can use, you said finding a conduit, and I was like, that's interesting. And I remember I wrote it down because I was like, you know, you see on TV or even in some people's specials where, you know, you'll see people go, this guy knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And then they'll continue on. But
I think that's why they do it, because it's a conduit. It's like a lightning rod for the laughs. Like everyone goes, ha ha ha, that guy. It's like we're comfortable with it or something.
Right.
I haven't fully understood. I can't fully understand every nuance of comedy, but the journey of trying to figure it out is like my favorite thing.
Just
trying to pick apart why things work, why things are funny, why certain things sound funny, you know, certain words just sound funny. And then like rhymes are funnier. There's so many little things. And you know, the other thing that's discouraging to some comics too, is like when all the low hanging fruit stuff works, all the really like all the racism and sexism and bullshit, you know, all the stereotype stuff. Like I always avoid it because it's like enough people are doing it and I hate it anyway, but it's discouraging to some people when that stuff always works. But I think that the key really is, how do we find jokes that like always work all the time? Maybe without that negative stuff. I think that stuff's got to be filtered out, but we still need a replacement for it. You know, we need a conduit. we need some lightning rod to make everyone laugh. Like my whole thing is like, how do we get everybody to laugh in unison at everything? You know, it's very hard. Everyone has pockets of opinions and they like this and they don't like that. And sometimes I find, and my friend Dan Venti was very good at this, looking at both sides of something, looking at this side and then the opposite side, and like making fun of both sides. Zoltan does it well too. You know, like if it's a gun control thing, he'll be like, I love guns. I want to talk about how much guns are awesome. I love shooting them, make you feel powerful. On the other hand, there's this. So it's like he hits both sides of it, you know? And I love comedy so much, man. I just think that life would be so just horrible without it. You know, it's the reason why when I watch a movie, if it doesn't have any comedy, I just think that's a shit movie. I don't care the genre. Like if it's a horror movie, like I love the Marvel movies. Those are my favorite movies. And people would say, you know, Scorsese, you say, oh, those aren't real cinema. That's bullshit. Those are real movies. They got everything in them. You know, they've got romance and action and comedy, and that's real life. That's why I like it. I know superhero stuff isn't real life, but just any movie that's just depressing all the way through is not real life. The life has ups and downs. It has sadness and it has comedy. And that's that balance of those two opposing things that make it such a roller coaster ride. You know, if you just make it funny the whole way or sad the whole way, that's not real life, you know? So it just doesn't feel right to me. And so I don't, the DC movies are garbage to me compared to the Marvel movies, because they're so different than life. I can't even picture this world they're describing, this dark world of grimness. And like, why are you even fighting to save people? You're so grim.
Yeah.
You know, at least in Marvel, it's like they'll joke and go have shawarma or whatever. I mean, that's real life, you know? And I think that's the thing that is so important about comedy, is it like does give that balance to the rest of this crap, you know?
Oh yeah. I mean, I 100% agree. I'm the kind of person that loves the Martin Scorsese and the really depressing movie.
I love Martin Scorsese movies, but those movies have some balance too. They have, you know, Goodfellas has, you know, violence, romance, comedy, tragedy. It has everything in it. It's not just one way. And you know, it's and I think those are the best movies, is the movie that really like has all of that emotional impact, not just one. You know, it can be depressing, but like The Departed, I just love that movie, The Departed.
I do too. That's one of my favorites.
It's such a great movie, and it does have some real sadness to it. But it's got, my favorite book is Lonesome Dove, and by extension, the movies that they did with Robert Duvall and Tommy Lee Jones. Those are so good. Like, that book is so sad. It's so brutally sad. There's so much heartbreak and loneliness and pain, but there's also all this humor, and it just feels like real life to me. You know, I think those are those things that I'm really like, how do we keep instilling all of our entertainment with comedy and not forget, like, this is an important component, you know?
Right. Whenever I go
coms and stuff, and you know, you got nothing without the com to me.
Oh yeah. I'm, for me, like, and I always, whenever I go watch like somebody live, like when I go see like a heavyweight comedian, somebody like, I went and saw Chris Rock one time when I was in New Orleans. And the reason I bought those tickets is because it was part of his tour that he did prior to the release of his last special that came out on Netflix. Mm-hmm. It was the first time I'd ever gone and seen like a giant before. Yeah. And I went because I thought Dave Chappelle was going to be there. He was there the night before, and I was like, hey, we're going to New Orleans tonight. I think Dave Chappelle is down there. It's All-Star. It's the All-Star game for the NBA. I think he's going to be there again tonight. And we drove down. And unfortunately, Dave Chappelle wasn't there. But Jeff Ross, Hannibal Buress, and Eric Andre opened for him.
Wow.
And
all the different styles. Oh, all different styles, yeah.
And the buddy that I brought with me, he kept – like looking over at me, because the whole time I was just sitting there like this, and he was like, are you not enjoying this? I'm like, oh, I'm having the time of my life. I'm just I'm picking it apart, like, at down to a scientific level. I'm like, why is this working so well? Like, I if I can watch somebody do stand up and really start laughing hard, and of course there's like, I'm always courteous, like, I don't just sit there like, you're gonna have to make me laugh. Like, if it's funny, I'm going to laugh at it, just as a, it's almost like clapping your hands to a comedian. But
you sound like you're in a daze, though, partly, you know.
Oh, yeah. Like, I'm sitting there. It's like a analyzing mind. It. Yeah. I'm like seeing all the little numbers and equations going around. That's how I'll watch it. I'll just sit there and like, wow, this is amazing.
Are there some comics, though, when you watch it, you forget about you doing that and you just start to laugh with it? Like, if I watch Eric Myers, who recently passed away, I just get pulled into his emotion. You know, I get pulled in so far that I forget to analyze it sometimes. And I'm just really, you know, I love letting go, you know, sometimes too. Like, I'll pick it apart. Like, for me, Eric Myers was just, he was so brilliant at comedy. He was such a master at like bringing emotion to every subject, you know, heightened, like, I'm screaming about Taco Bell, you know, like getting that worked up about a mundane subject to me is so hysterical. And now, of course, I'm analyzing it after the fact, but I think during the moment I get pulled in and I'm just laughing. You know, I watch Zoltan, I laugh uncontrollably. I'm sitting next to my friend and he's not laughing at all. And I said the same thing. I go, are you not? He goes, oh, I hate watching him. It makes me want to quit. And I'm like, I have the opposite reaction. I'm drawn in and I just want to do that. I want to be that. And I enjoy it. Like, I think there's a freedom of like, yeah, I can still really like let myself laugh and enjoy it. You know, I wonder if there's a comic like that for you that makes you forget, you know?
For me, as far as forgetting while I'm watching them, I've never gone to see him live, and that's like a huge bucket list thing for me, is Dave Chappelle. He is sitting at the top of the Mortal Kombat tower for me. I think he is
the greatest. Yeah,
his last special, and this is gonna make you probably ball up in the corner and start crying, but his last special I actually did not go to because my wife didn't want to go. We were on our way to Gatlinburg that weekend and he announced, hey, I'm going to be at the Tabernacle in Atlanta. And the route that we were taking, we were like 30 minutes outside of Atlanta. And I was like, look, we could stop for the night in Atlanta and we can go see Dave Chappelle. The tickets are $60 a piece. Oh, you're not going to get to go see him for this cheap. And we had just gone a few months prior to that, we went to go see Chris D'Elia at the Tabernacle. So it was like, we knew where the club was and everything. And she was like, no, I'd rather just get to Gatlinburg. And then
that's because the last time she saw Chris D'Elia, just
kidding. Yeah.
How was that show? Was it good, actually?
It was good. Yeah, yeah. It was neat watching it and then watching his special.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually got to meet him not too long after I moved here. I went up to the Comedy Store to see Joe Rogan. Uh-huh. And I was walking around in the hallway, and there was Chris D'Elia. And I was like, that was what made that place so magical. It was like, you could pay $20 and you'd watch Joe Rogan do an hour, and you'd go to the bathroom and bump into. I saw Ron White. I got my picture taken with Chris D'Elia. I saw Steve Byrne. I saw Whitney Cummings. And I was just like you talk about loving those Marvel movies. Like, I felt like I was standing around all the Marvel superheroes. I was like,
oh, I know.
This is amazing.
It's huge. I got to host a show at the Improv once that was loaded with comics like that. So I'm the host and I'm going on doing time. And then I'm bringing up just like, you know, like the Drew Carey level stars. You know, I had Chris D'Elia, who was very nice. I have to say, he was totally nice to me. In fact, he was like, God damn, that Dane Cook is here. Yeah, I can't stand him. He's going to steal my jokes. That's what he said. Then I introduced Dane Cook, and he was very nice too. He was even nicer than Chris D'Elia.
Yeah.
And both of those guys killed. And then Owen Benjamin went on after them and did this piano act. And he killed her even harder than they did. I mean, he murdered, destroyed, killed harder than... I think the hardest I've ever seen anyone kill, by the way, for like that amount of time, besides Owen Benjamin, was John Witherspoon.
Oh, okay.
Pops. And he was opening for Cat Williams. And Cat Williams destroyed, you know, for an hour and a half or whatever it was. Murdered. But the 20 minutes of John Witherspoon that came on like three or four comics before, because Cat Williams had a lot of openers, but John Witherspoon was on earlier in the act, and it was maybe my favorite 20 minutes of stand-up I've ever seen. I mean, it was incredible. And the guy, you know, he was so smart because he did all of his movie stuff first. He like got it out of the way. He goes on and he goes, you know, people would shout out his lines at him if he didn't do this, I think. So instead, he would preempt that by saying, you know, when I'm in the bathroom, you know, I'm in the kitchen, I'm in the bathroom, don't come in here before 35 minutes. He's doing all the stuff, you're in the kitchen eating the pig's feet. He's doing all his lines from Friday. He's doing all kinds of lines from all kinds of stuff. And people are dying. He's going through them all. And then he goes into his act. And I mean, every joke was murdering. Granted, it was like 20,000 people in like a huge arena, but nobody else was killing like that, you know. And I mean, I couldn't even breathe. I was laughing so hard, you know. And it's funny because I've gone on since to like watch the YouTube him, find other stuff from John Witherspoon, and really all I can find is that same set everywhere, and it's amazing, and I love it. But I think that's the hardest I've ever seen anyone just murdering, you know.
I saw in November of 2019, I went to the La Jolla Comedy Store and I saw Donnell Rollins. And I took my wife with me, and that's the thing with her is like, she knows I'm such
again, you were hoping Dave Chappelle would show up again, right? That's why.
I mean, I figured I was like, if Dave Chappelle walks in here, my head is gonna explode. And I mean, I'll talk about that. Like, I'll have a couple of drinks and we'll just be sitting on the couch and I'll start on this comedy rant that's an hour and 30 minutes long. And I'm like, if I ever get to get a picture with him, I was like,
I know you, if you ever get to see Bill Burr, you'd just be like, I was just really hoping Dave Chappelle would show up.
I mean, here. I would love to meet Bill Burr. I think he's fantastic, but I mean, that's like, he's the one. To me, if I can get that picture of him, like, I will remove family pictures in my house to put that one in.
To me, I put him on a level of like, if I was alive, if Rodney Dangerfield was alive when I was alive, like I worship his whole approach to stand up. I just think he's the funniest human being. The book that he, the autobiography he has, is so funny from top to bottom. He starts every chapter with a joke. He's just, Rodney Dangerfield was amazing. You know, I think like Rodney and Richard Pryor and like, just like in that few, like they're the Dave Chappelle's of all time. You know, I just think, and plus Dave Chappelle is like, he's a DC guy. He grew up in that area, didn't he? Or he was from somewhere else. And then he was in DC for a while. I know his DC set is like my favorite stand-up special, Killing Him Softly. That's my favorite stand-up special of any one stand-up special. You know his bit at the end about being taken to the hood when you don't know you're going, and the baby and all that? For the long, I mean, that still might be my favorite bit. I mean, I just think it's so funny, and it just reminds me of like growing up in that Northern Virginia area and being going into DC with people for things, and like that whole scenario just was so perfectly done. You know, I think he's the funniest comic ever, especially the body of work he's now put together, because even Richard Pryor doesn't have like that many specials, or Eddie Murphy. It's like, yeah, you got Chris Rock is like that pure stand-up comic powerhouse too, that I just think he's almost underrated at this point. But Chris Rock is like a murderer, you know.
Oh, yeah. And even Chris Rock will go on record and say, like, when Dave Chappelle walks in, I feel fear in my heart. As far as, and as good as he is and as the body of work that he's created, he still is like, there's an interview with, I think it's him and I believe Kevin Hart, and they're at the Comedy Cellar in New York. And they're sitting there and, you know, they got their sets and they're going over stuff, and they both go up, and then Dave Chappelle walks in and he's like, yeah, I think I'm going to go up for a few minutes. And within like the first 10 minutes, they just look at each other and ball up what they have and throw it in the trash. Cause they're like, this dude, he's beyond anything we've written down.
I think he reminds me a little bit of like Patrice O'Neill. Did you ever see Patrice O'Neill stand up?
I just watched his, I've seen his special Elephant in the Room multiple times.
Yeah.
But I watched his documentary not too long ago.
Okay. I haven't seen that. I got to see that. But yeah, I think Patrice O'Neill was a just brilliant genius comedian who, if he had lived longer, maybe would have achieved that status. So, you know, the Dave Chappelle level, because he was just fearless. And to me, like this later Dave Chappelle stuff takes a page out of that Patrice O'Neill book. You know, like Dave's act has evolved over time, and it's become even more daring. And I think Patrice was really amazing. You know, I feel like I could see how you would have watched that and been a fan of that if you like Dave Chappelle.
Oh,
you know,
yeah. That's pretty much stadium. I mean, I'll listen to one person. I'll finish this one point about Dave Chappelle, and I'll get to talking about this guy, because right now this dude is like, okay, I think this guy might be the next wave. But as far as Dave Chappelle goes, my personal favorite special of his is For What It's Worth, the one that he did after Killing Them Softly. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I think I like that one so much was, I believe when that came out, I was 11 or 12 years old. And I remember staying up late at my dad's house, because he had like premium cable. And if you stayed up late, Comedy Central would be uncensored at a certain time. And then they'd be like, coming up next, we have Dave Chappelle's Killing Them, For What It's Worth. And I remember sitting there watching that at like 12 years old, like trying to keep it turned down so nobody would come in there and tell me to cut it off. And I just thought it was like the very first joke where he's talking about the homeless guy on the bus, and like everybody, I won't go into too much detail about it, but you know what I'm talking about. That to me, to this day, is so funny. But that was the last special he put out before going away.
Yeah.
You know, and he was talking about like the effects that fame had had on him, and that show that he was doing, how, you know, detrimental it was to pretty much his whole personal life. And that's really why he walked away. He didn't like who he was becoming. And now he's like rewriting what it means to be in a contract with a major company and all of this stuff. And he's being so open about it. And that's what I'm really enjoying now, is seeing him older. And he's like, I run me. You don't own the name Chappelle. It's mine. So
I wish you didn't smoke so much.
Yeah, that really worried me. When he caught COVID, I got really scared. When they said he had COVID, I was like, please, no, just let him get through this.
I felt that way. And I just, when I watched the later special, like, my favorite rapper was Sean Price from Helter Skelter. And he sounded like this in later years, where the voice is grittier and grimier and great for rap music, but man, it wasn't good for his life, his health. You know, I don't know if it was just from cigarettes or what, but yeah, Dave, it bothers me hearing his voice change like that.
Well, I mean, he is a lot older than, like, Killing Them Softly. I think he was maybe 25 when that came out.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't remember which special it was that he had recently. He smoked so much during the special that it made me thirsty. I needed water to watch it. He's never drinking any water, and he's just smoking and smoking. He's vaping and smoking, and I'm like, whew, I can't handle this. Like, I feel worried about it. Isn't that weird? Like, I care about him so much that I'm like, please stop smoking, Dave.
You just want him to keep going forever. Really, it's like, please just.
I want him to be healthy. I don't even care if he does another joke. I just want him to not die of lung cancer like my grandfather. Like, it's just a horrible way to, like, drown.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, I mean, and I can't say what, you know, whatever, but I'm just saying, like, to smoke that much, it's like, man.
I'll tell you this much. I know you've seen me do this quite a few times since we've been on here. And that right there got me off of like a pack and a half a day. And it's been.
That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Because, I mean, I would go on deployments and I would just either be drinking or just being at work and, hey, let's go smoke. Okay. And, you know, you just sit there and just, you get used to it after a while. And I moved out here to California and they're talking $8 a pack. And I'm like, I got to figure something else out. And I did the Juul for a little while, but even that's more expensive than smoking. So I found that alternative. And ever since I bought that, I haven't looked back.
That's amazing.
And, you know, I'm slowly weaning myself off of it. It's just, this is what I feel comfortable with right now. And, you know,
I love that. I think that's great. I mean, anything to reduce it, that's, you need to send one over to Dave.
Hey, I've seen him. He had his little vape on one of his specials. I think it was Equanimity. He pulled it out and a fan asked if they could hit it. And he was like, no, I don't want herpes. And everybody just died laughing. But
hey, he's not even joking right there.
Yeah.
You know,
one guy that I wanted to ask you about, just to see if he's kind of on your radar, because I think he's really blown up over the past year, is Andrew Schultz.
I haven't seen enough to really have an opinion. If you like him, I'll have to check it out. Can you remind me of his stuff? I can't.
Absolutely.
I can't even think of it right now.
I'll send it to you in an email after this is over. Over the past year, and a lot of the people that I get turned on to are just from, like, they're on somebody else's podcast. Like, that's really, that's better than being on television these days, especially if you get on one like Joe Rogan or something like that. And, you know, he went on there and I liked a lot of the stuff he was saying, and he just has such this insane business type mind for how comedy and entertainment might work, and he's also really funny behind it.
I just need to see what he looks like, really fast. Andrew Schultz.
Yep. So essentially.
Oh yeah. Okay. I have seen him. He has some kind of podcast. It's him and another guy. They were talking about, they're talking about Michael Rappaport. being a bitch about something. That's where I saw him. So I haven't seen his stand up, but I can tell he's very funny from the podcast and very very quick, and he's going back and forth.
He has I don't mean to interrupt you.
Rappaport hard, but
he has a special on YouTube called the Crowdwork Special that he actually released the same day that Dave Chappelle released Sticks and Stones.
Hmm.
And so, you know, that's like a blockbuster on Netflix. Yeah. Like, oh, Dave Chappelle has a new comedy special out. And he was like, you know what? I'm going to drop one today, too. And they were like, well, what?
People might like, miss it, but.
He was like, I'm still on tour, you know, so I can't give out my material that I want to do for my special. So I'm just going to put out 30 minutes worth of just pure crowd work. And it's like, for somebody like me, watching somebody just go out there and just do pure crowd work for 30 minutes, it was like, this is insane.
Yeah.
And just to put that out there, because you know just as well as I do, your material is like gold. The more of it you have, you can eventually, and that's actually going to lead me into probably my last question for you is, you know, your material, once you get a good joke and you have it really worked out, and that's like, okay, this is going to be great. You want to save it. You take real good care of it. It's like eggs in a basket. So for somebody like me, the longest set I've ever done was 10 minutes. So getting told, hey, we're going to ask you to do this 15-minute little short special for this veterans thing. Do you think you can do it? That was like, yeah, because I'll just add another 5 minutes onto the 10 minutes that I can do. But then you see this like, for me, like looking up at people to do that hour, it seems so daunting because it's like, okay, well, I can do 5 minutes, and I break it down into, well, what if I just did 20 different 5 minute sets and I just put them all together? But obviously it's not going to quite work like that. I guess here, I'll make sure I'm asking you the question correctly. So the question that I have is, when did you decide it was time to take the next step, like from open micer to opener to feature and even to headliner?
Well, I don't know that you ever take a step. It's just that you progress at whatever rate you're progressing, and then hopefully opportunities will present themselves. Like, people will ask you, can you do 10 minutes? Can you do 15 minutes? Can you do 20 minutes? And getting prepared to do those along the way is what is the important part. You know, I've always just wanted to be a headliner. So even when I was doing open mics, I'm like restless. I just want, hurry up, get to the, let's get them done. Let's go move it. I hate when there's like 10 comics on before me and I'm waiting and waiting and waiting, and they're wearing everybody out and they're tired. I just want to get up there. So I've always been, I'm very comfortable doing the feature act because it's easy. And in the middle, and I'd much rather do that than host or open. But I like going on first and being done, getting it over with. I hate the waiting. I get so nervous just waiting and being anxious of like, it's coming. I just start picking apart everything. Like, look, this person's being too dirty. They're doing all this crowd work. I still got to do 45 minutes or whatever. So yeah, I think, I don't know. I would say this though, you know, you never really feel ready. Like people will go, oh, can you do this? And you're like, I don't know if I can do it. I've never felt ready for anything. I've always felt like, I'm not sure. I don't know. But I think the people that really succeed, they take those opportunities even so. They just step forward, while a lot of timid people will just step back. Some people would go, I don't know if I'm ready. It's those people that go, screw it, let's try it. Yes, I'll do an hour, and they've got 15 minutes. I think that happened with Bobby Lee. I think he got some kind of TV special or something, and he only had 15 minutes, and he agreed to do it. And then it's kind of like either rise to the occasion, or you know, or do what he did. I think he stole a bunch of Wally Wong's jokes and did them on the special, and then he later apologized to Wally Wong. That's another story. But yeah, I just think like you never are told. There's no landmarks, you know, there's no like postmarks going, oh, now you're ready to be this, now you're ready to that. I just feel like once someone says, hey, do you want a feature for me? And you're doing it consistently, it's like, okay, well, that's what I'm doing now, you know? And then you get really sharp at that 20 minutes, like the 20 to 25 minutes that you do every night over and over as a feature, you get so good at that. But the idea, at least for me, and Zoltan mentioned it, like train for the job you want. You watch the headliner, what they're doing. They're doing an hour, they're doing 45 to an hour, and you need to pace yourself that way. Like if I did my 20 minutes and race through it and it's all high energy, and then I like, what do I do for the next 40, you know? So I have to sort of think about if I'm headlining, like this has to last a lot longer. How do I get through it? Maybe a little bit is you do a piece of material, you react to it, you do a little crowd work, you go back to material, and you kind of pace it that way until you get to an hour, you know? I think the most amount of time I ever did was an hour and a half. And it was way before I was prepared to do it. You know, like I still don't have an hour and a half. I forget, we were at some pool hall thing. It was me and Dangerous Dick and Christian Spicer and a few other comics. And they were like doing the marathon. Like they wanted to fill like 8 hours. It was like their goal was like to do comedy all day or something. And so each one of us, I think Dangerous Dick did 2 hours by himself, you know, and Chip Nicholson did 2.5 hours or some insane amount of time. So a lot of it was crowd work and talking to the waitress as she walked by and, you know, some of that. Is that all A material? No, I don't think that would, you know, qualify me to be a headliner. At that point, doing an hour and a half of crap is not a headliner. You know, headliner is like A material that's like every joke hits with the majority of the audience for a whole hour. To me, that's a headliner, you know?
Yeah.
I think you know when you get there, because that's what's happening. Once you get there, then you know, like, I'm ready. I can do this now, you know?
And even those guys will tell you, like, they'll prepare an hour worth of work, an hour worth of material, and they'll go on tour with that for maybe a year. And then at the very end of that tour is when they film their special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they got it down perfectly. And they got it down. And then they have to write a crap load of new stuff, or they've been writing a crap load of new stuff but not performing it and saving it. And now the whole next year is working out that next hour.
Right.
Like the Louis C.K.'s, you know, he's got like a new hour every year or whatever. And what he used to do was he would take his old closer. You know, the best joke that he's got in his whole set is closer. He'd make it the opener in the next year's hour or whatever. That means he would now have to follow his best joke. Put, you know, he put pressure on himself. I'm going to close, you know, open with this best closer. I thought that was pretty ambitious of him.
I guess for me, because a lot of the opportunities that I get, like here in California, you get anywhere between 3 to 5 minutes. And if you're lucky, you may get, you know, somewhere 7 to 10 at the level that I'm currently at. So for me, like I feel like I'm funniest if I can tell a story. So a lot of my jokes are not real 1-2 punchline type of jokes. A lot of them are like, so the other day this happened, yada, 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 mm-hmm. yada, punchline. And then I try and go in the middle and plug in as many little laughs as I can leading up to the big punch at the end. So I feel like actually sitting down and putting together an hour wouldn't be difficult if I could tell these long stories. And this kind of touches on what you said in the beginning on, like, you got to have a kind of a point of what you're trying to say.
Yeah.
So for doing these little 3-minute sets, it's tough because I'm like, okay, I want to try and put 3 jokes in here. So I'm like, okay, I got 60 seconds to tell this joke. I got 30 seconds to tell this joke, and then I'll have 1.5 minutes to tell this last one. And that's just kind of the way I look at it. I look at everything like time. Like, yeah. Okay, how much time am I currently at? And to the point to where, and I want to get away from doing this because this is another thing that I do, is I will memorize a set because, like, this show that I did last November, it's the first time I'd done stand-up in almost 8 months, so I wanted it to go great. So I rehearsed and I rehearsed and I wrote it over and over again. And I did well, but people that have seen me do stand-up multiple times, like, oh, you're being robotic. You're not being how you are. Yeah. You're not being you at your funniest. And previous to shutdown, I started to experiment a little bit. Me and a buddy, we went up to the Comedy Palace one night. I'd done signed up for open mic, and he's like, "What are you gonna talk about?" I was like, "I don't know. I'm just gonna go up there and feel it." And I went up and talked about all of the crazy shit we talked about in the car on the way up there. And he was just like, he thought I was up there doing magic. He was like, "That is what you need to do every time."
Yeah.
And I was like, "That's so scary to do." Cause you know, when you're just doing a small little, you know, everybody else in the room is a comic, you know, who cares if you bomb?
Yeah.
You know, you're just trying out material. Like, is this good? When you're just up there kind of winging it, you got somebody filming it for you, so you can go back and pick out the things that you like. It's a little bit easier, but doing that in front of like a packed crowd that paid money to see you, or, you know, see a showcase of people that should be doing pretty well, you know, it just seems kind of daunting to me.
I hear what you're saying. I think what they're responding to, though, is how real you are. You know, they're really responding to how loose, conversational, and vulnerable you are. You know, you are up there just talking about something you experienced in the car just a minute ago. And they can sense that this isn't pre-written, that this isn't a monologue. It's just unfiltered, your feelings, you know? And I think if you can present everything in that way, like even if you reproduce that, like you do that 100 times, that same bit or that same story, the idea is how to deliver it with that natural cadence, you know, that conversational way. I think I told you once that I like to rehearse something and, you know, memorize something until I've got it down so memorized. And then I try to rough it up a little bit in the delivery, you know, so that in delivering it, I might fumble and pretend to search for a word so that it comes off like magic. It comes off like this is off the top of the dome, right? And to me, that's part of the magician flair of delivery, of like, it almost shouldn't look as polished as we think it should be, you know? Like on TV, it looks so polished and perfect, but also they're very comfortable, you know? And that's kind of what we're gravitating to, is their confidence and their comfort. And I feel like that comes across more when you're just relaxed and being yourself and not judging it so much, you know? And my other point I would make too is, you know, when you talk about timing those jokes and trying to fit like this one with this one into this 3 minutes, it's almost like those jokes don't necessarily go together, but they're being fit together like a jigsaw because of the time constraint. And so that also takes away some of that natural way that you would communicate, of letting one topic flow to the next one that it reminds you of. You know what I mean? So right. At some level, there's this subconscious thing that the audience is tuning into that is like our level of realness, you know?
Right.
So when I think your friend is saying like, you should do that all the time, that's something to really consider, you know, is like, do what all the time? What exactly about it was working, you know? Was it that particular topic? Probably not. Was it that story? Maybe not. It was the fact that you were delivering, you know, your persona was different. Your delivery was different.
Right.
That's the key to it. It was really super real.
It's just like you said, like, it's so hard to be as funny as you are doing that kitchen comedy. Like, I know when I'm doing it. If I'm in front of a couple of people and I might have had a drink or two and I'm feeling it, and I just start going on a rant, and when everybody's like engaged listening to you and they're all laughing and it's just punch, 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 you know, you can feel that same, that like golden moment sensation where you're like, man, they're really into this story. And then you're like, I should write this down. This is great.
Yeah.
And then you write it down and it's polished, and you go up in front of a crowd with a microphone in your hand and it doesn't have the same effect. And that's one of the mysteries. I don't think a lot of people ever figure out. And that's one of the things that, you know, that will drive, that will keep me awake at night, is trying to figure out how do I be that guy.
Well, I think the one thing we tend to forget too is that every single audience is totally different. And the audience actually plays a huge part in how the whole thing goes down. You know, your chemistry with the audience just may not be there that day, and part of it might be them. Like, they are just not vibing with what you're presenting in that particular moment in time and space, and everything. It's just not lining up perfectly. They came to see this guy or this gal or this, you know, this kind of act, or they left the house with this in mind, or they're busy eating right when you're doing a premise, they missed it. Or, you know, it's just like so many nuances. Like, your opening joke, they miss one word, you fumble one word, and now you're just the moment, you know. It's so variable, and that's what makes it so exciting. You know, it's like, how do we polish this so well that the product has a really high percentage chance of working in this really variable environment, like different places, different states in the country, different interests, different political feelings, different everything every night. You know, it's like, how do you make that act work? Maybe you can't, maybe it's never going to be perfect, you know, but we just kind of get closer and closer to that is like the goal, I think, of like, how do we make the most amount of people love it, you know?
Oh yeah. Like, even being able to see like the change in like what energy you need to have just for in relationship with the comic that went before you. Like, whenever I went back and I did that show in Birmingham back in November, the guy that went before me, he was a real big guy, and he came out and he sat down on the stool, and you know, he just kind of looked around, and he was real slow and methodical. He was funny, but it was very slow.
Mm-hmm.
And then, all right, we're going to bring our next comic out, and I'm standing right there behind the curtain. And the guy that's, you know, the MC, he's got a purple suit on. I mean, he's dressed to the nines, and he's like, all right, we got our guy coming out here all the way from San Diego, California, but he's home right now, introducing Taylor Dunn. And they started playing music, and I just went on my instinct and I started dancing when I came out behind that curtain, and that crowd went crazy.
What was the music? Do you remember?
I want to say it was like
Sweet Home Alabama or something.
No. It was like Snoop Dogg, like, okay, Gin and Juice or something. It was something like that. And I just, nice. I like started crip walking across the stage. Don't look like a guy who would be doing a dance like that. That's, I think, amazing. Me and one other person on the show were white. Everybody else was African-American, or no, I think everybody else on the show was African-American. It was me and one other white woman. And
so you got that caveat too of like, I'm the white boy.
Yeah.
And I'm the token white boy on this show, and I'm gonna play up my nerdiness but also dance coming out. I mean, it's amazing.
They liked it so much. The host was laughing, and then he was like, man, we're gonna have to see you do it again. So I leaned in the microphone and I was like, y'all wanna see me do that one more time? And everybody, yeah. And I did it again. They turned the music back on. And,
oh, that's great. I would have hated to follow that.
Yeah, because as soon as I got done doing it, that was what was a little bit weird about the show, is because they kind of introduced everybody before they started, almost like a talent search type of deal.
Okay.
And they were like, you know, so where are you from? And I'm like, well, I grew up right here in Alabama, but right now I'm living in San Diego, California. And he's like, well, what do you do for a living? And I was like, I would tell you, but that's going to ruin one of my jokes. And he was like, all right, well, take it away. And my very first thing out of my mouth was that joke that I told when I was part of that, that comedy class, where I was like, all right, I'm not a cop. And it just lit that place on fire. And I was like, here we go. This is the energy that I was looking for.
That's the perfect joke for that, you know, situation. That's just great.
I mean, it was such a good feeling. And that's, I'm so eager to get back to it. You know, I've just trying to stay motivated writing, and just, I've started reading several books on comedy. There's a Judy Carter book. I have her first one. That was, I bought that one before I even started, but she just released a new one where it's about doing comedy in the 21st century with social media and all the different applications that you can use. And, you know, I'm going through that. I got the workbook and everything. So I'm really just trying to put together a bigger act, not just do these little 5-minute sets and okay, this is great. I'm trying to, okay, let me come out of this. I say lockdown, even though it looks like we're coming out of it. When the military lets me go out and enjoy freedom again, I want to come out and have 30 minutes that I can do. And if I had more than that, that would be perfect.
Yeah.
But that's kind of my goal, is let me put together a good 30 minutes.
I love that goal. And I could see you doing that a lot easier maybe than you think because of your sort of writing chops. You know how when we're doing the class, I would always talk about act outs. You know, you'd give the premise and then you would sort of exemplify it with an act out between characters. When you're describing sort of the initial experience of coming to class having already written your own scene, that's exactly like where I think you can take it in stand-up, is writing dialogue. You know, like I write a lot of scripts now for marketing for commercials and stuff like that, where they want to make it funny. And for me, I like to start with the dialogue. Like one person says this, how would the other character respond? And I wonder if you could frame some of your new material or some of the writing that you're thinking about doing in that sort of framework of dialogue in a scene, you know, between two actors, and see sort of what kind of scene you could write. And then can you perform that on stage by yourself?
That's pretty interesting. I've never really thought of it like that, because when I talk about doing those, like those kitchen comedy shows for just my wife or my daughter, I'll talk and I'll tell, man, you won't believe what this person said at work today. And I'll act it out and I do the other person's voice, and you know, and it, you don't even realize that you're doing it.
Right.
And that's what she thinks is the funniest. That's what my friends think is the funniest, is just, the stuff that you do naturally is when you sit down and you see that cursor blinking at you. It's like, for some reason, it's so hard to recreate that.
I know. It is. It is. And that's why I'm wondering if, you know, starting from that point of writing it as dialogue, it wouldn't help propel it along, you know, because you naturally do that anyway. And to me, that's sort of the strength of like the greats. The Richard Pryor is, he will act out a story in character, in different characters, doing different voices. And exactly the way you describe, of turning this way, using a voice, turning this way, doing a different voice and a different physical characterization. And since you already kind of have the ability to do those performances, now it's like a matter of writing it. And, you know, I'm now that I'm writing a lot of these scenes that are short like this, for me, that's the best jumping off part, is like, what does the first person say? How do they respond to it? Again, this is all imaginary scenarios, but I think it's an interesting thought of a direction in writing material for stand-up.
I mean, that feels like something I could start working on immediately. Like, I don't know why I'll sit there and be like, should I talk about topical things? No, I feel like everybody's going to be talking about that. Well, I'll start talking about this. My biggest thing is like stepping on somebody else's joke. Mm-hmm. Like if somebody goes up and talks about Black Lives Matter, and I have a joke about Black Lives Matter for 3-minute sets, it's like, okay, well, I don't want to talk about that because they just ended on a really good joke about that. Let me, you know, talk about something else. So I try to talk about, for these little short sets, I try to talk about stuff that would only pertain to me.
Yeah. I like that angle.
Nobody else could talk about. So.
And true, you know, the fact is, like, when you go back to stand up after this, everyone's got a joke about masks and COVID and quarantine. So you do want to be different and not do the same crap that everybody's doing. I mean, we've all got those jokes, but what else do we have, you know? And I think with you, it's you that's unique, you know, same with everybody. We bring the unique to the situation because it's only one of us. So it's our perspective, you know? But yeah, I think that your sort of script writing or scene writing could help inform the stand-up writing. And as I'm writing these little scripts, that's kind of what I'm thinking about is, how do I do another scene like this, but in my stand-up, you know? So
that's awesome.
It's an interesting thought.
Man, we've been on here for going on 2 hours.
I know. It's been a great conversation though, man.
Hey, I really appreciate you sitting down with me. Last thing I'll ask is, you know, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Let's say COVID clears up in a month or two and you can perform at your heart's desire. What goal do you have for yourself?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, I wasn't really sure where things were going. In this whole past year, it's been really, you know, a feeling of being lost and not sure where I'll be when it comes back. I think as comedy is starting to come back, I'm starting to go on the road a little bit with Vicky featuring again, sort of training to do her job as much as I can, as much as opportunity arises. I had my comedy special come out right before the pandemic. It was on Dry Bar Comedy. I kind of thought that would propel me into other things, and it's so far hasn't, which means I think I need another special or another album. I tried to put out an album and it got fouled up. So I think in the next 5 years, I want to put out an album, a special, and move closer to being a headliner on my own. And I don't know if stand-up is going to be fundamentally changed over the course of the next few years with how things have gone this last year. But I think that the pay rates are so bad for stand-up that it's like you have to be able to do something else. So what will that be? I don't know. I think it's, you know, at least with me, I get a lot of pleasure out of podcasting. The D&D comedy podcast that we do as a group is really, really fun. My goal eventually would be to do some of those live and perform the, you know, because a lot of that is voice acting and doing character work and stuff that I just love. I realized over the course of my life that, like, I like a little bit of variety. So if I do one thing all the time too long, it takes the magic out of it. If I just stand up every night for a month, I get sick of it. So I actually need to pepper in other experiences and figure out what else I can do. And I'm not sure what that'll be, but, you know, getting married and hopefully looking for a new place with Anna and myself, just sort of moving forward in the next 5 years. And my next, you know, my real goal is always to be happy, no matter what I'm doing, is to avoid being depressed. So I think that's my real goal, is like, as long as life is fun and I'm happy and experiencing new things, I'll never be disappointed. Oh, I'm not a headline. I'm not where I want to be as like a big famous comedian. I don't really care about that so much as really enjoying the time that I have left. And, you know, and this last year has just sort of reinforced how precious time is, life is, our health, and really appreciating the moment, you know, really being able to be present, even in this interview with you, just to be like, I'm enjoying our exchange of ideas, and this is all that matters right now. There's nothing else, you know. The past is gone, the future doesn't really exist, it's just this moment that we have. And so if I can appreciate this moment, I'll be a happy person. That's the real goal for me. Yeah,
absolutely, man. That's, man, I don't think you could have put that any better.
Thanks, man.
But yeah, like I said, I appreciate you sitting down with me. I wish you and your new fiance, you know, abundance of success. I look Thank forward you. To seeing you at the comedy clubs whenever I For can. Sure. I'll definitely be there. Man. If you're doing a show, if it's you're headlining, or even if you're just featuring for Vicky or whoever, I'll try and be there if I can.
Thank you, brother. I really appreciate that. And I'm really looking forward to watching your journey. And if you ever need anything, even if you just want to run by a joke or material or just chat, please hit me up anytime. My favorite thing is talking comedy, as you can see.
Oh yeah. It's hard finding people. Like when you talk about it with anybody else, they don't really get like, why are you breaking it down like this? Yeah. Why are you such a nerd about it? And I'm like, you just don't understand. Like there's a sweet science to it that I can't explain to you. And
I'm sure it's why boxers keep boxing even after they get brain damage. And it's why we keep going after we get hurt and bomb and everything else, you know?
Absolutely.
Because we love it. So got to do it.
Well, all right, man. Hey, my little girl is banging on the door right now. So I think that's my cue to end this.
All right, brother. I love you, man. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. My best on everything. Good luck and break a leg.
Hey, I appreciate it, brother. Same to you.